Greetings and salutation. Welcome to another episode of my podcast. I'm Harold C. Connolly Jr., an explorer of space, time, and the human experience. And I do so in very specific ways, as you probably know from listening to my other podcast. I do so as being founding chair and professor of the Department of Geology at Rowan University in southern New Jersey, and also as being mission sample scientist of OSIRIS-REx, which is NASA's New Frontiers 3 asteroid sample return mission, and as being a co-investigator on JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency's asteroid sample return mission, Hayabusa 2. And today I'm coming to you from the Drake Building of the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, which is the hub, the center of the OSIRIS-REx mission. It's my great pleasure to be here today with Dr. Mike Nolan. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Harold.
And Mike is the science team chief scientist and has a long career in planetary science. How did you come to planetary science to begin with?
I came to planetary science because I was a very bad chemist.
I didn't know that.
Actually, I was an undergraduate student at Caltech in chemistry, and my senior year, I was done with most of my requirements. Right, I had a few things to finish up, and I said, "Well, what do they have here at Caltech that I will not find somewhere else? What should I do here? Because it's a great place to do something like that. I mean, it might be interesting to go take a." So I did that, and I ended up taking planetary science courses, and then
with whom? Just many of them.
I took about four or five.
Okay.
So I liked them, so I kept taking them.
Okay.
So I took an atmospheres course with Andy Ingersoll.
Oh yeah.
I took a surface course with Bruce Murray.
Yeah.
And
because I was a postdoc at Caltech, if you remember. Yeah.
And with Gene Shoemaker.
Oh okay.
One or two more.
Okay.
And so I liked that, and I actually went to graduate school for a year in chemistry, and at some point realized that I was having difficulty, and the difficulty was a lack of interest.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're not interested, being a graduate student and not interested in what you're doing is a waste of everybody's time.
Yes, very bad.
So I transferred to the University of Arizona as a graduate student in planetary science. I had applied there sort of on the because of those other courses and had just not really changed course. So I said, no, it's time to change course. Ended up at the University of Arizona many years ago as a graduate student. Loved it. Did much better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got into planetary science.
Okay. Who did you work with for your PhD?
My advisor was Richard Greenberg,
who's
a theoretician mostly, who was working on the Galileo mission.
Oh, right.
And, And then also did a lot with Jay Malosh for some numerical modeling. And that's how I mostly got to the things I was doing.
So you have quite a long history with missions.
I suppose we didn't have a
after a fashion.
My connection with the Galileo mission was extremely tenuous.
Okay. Well, how did you get into radio astronomy?
So then, I graduated in the early 90s, and to be honest, the funding situation in the early 90s for just the number of jobs available in the field was very, very small.
Okay,
and so. In fact, my advisor said, "Oh, you should apply for this job." I said, "Yeah, but there are 200 applicants for that job, and if I were them, I would hire this person."
Okay.
And there's 200 applicants for this other job, and I'm pretty sure this is the one who's going to get. That's who I would hire for that job. And there's only the two jobs, so I had to look a little farther afield, and the Arecibo Observatory was undergoing a major upgrade.
What?
The Arecibo Observatory.
The Arecibo, yeah, of course.
In Arecibo, Puerto Rico, was undergoing a major upgrade. And one of the main things they were going to be able to do was imaging of near-Earth asteroids. Before the upgrade, they had done it had imaged one near-Earth asteroid and observed a few more. The increase of sensitivity by a factor of about 20. And you can do new things if you do an order of magnitude better. And so I ended up there and basically was one of the main ones who sort of made that system do that thing. When I got there, they were still in the upgrade, and so I got a lot of experience with the technical aspects of doing it. And so I ended up staying there for about 20 years.
Right.
Ended up as the observatory director and a few other positions along the way.
So you became an engineer and an administrator along the process.
Got to be all those things. And then it was the same thing, is that I speak engineer and I speak scientist. Right. And so I was able to talk to the engineers in a way that let us... if you ask an engineer a very specific question, can you X? They will say, that will cost this many dollars.
Sure.
The thing that when you have especially a one-of-a-kind instrument that's already built, what you want to say is, how? Let me ask that question a bunch of different ways and find what's easy? What changes could you make to this that are easy, especially if we make them now, right, in the design phase?
Right.
For example, it turns out that many telescopes are designed by astronomers who are looking at the fixed stars. So the idea that you want to be looking at a moving object is not something they're thinking about.
Mm.
And so if somebody comes along later and says, can I look at a planet? It's like, oh, that's hard because we're not used to doing it. But if they had been included in the design at the beginning, it would have been quite easy.
Right, sure.
Right? It would have been easy to include those equations in the math when you did it to start with.
Sure,
but
sure.
Adding it on later is difficult.
Right.
So mostly what we did is a lot of thinking about what is it we're likely to want to do this and put a lot of flexibility in so that we could do...
Mm.
interesting experiments as we went and we tried to build a lot of very flexible equipment so that somebody could come and have a neat idea and we would say, we can do that. I have a great story about this actually.
Yeah.
So the mini RF, I guess it was Chandrayaan the first time, but there are radar instruments on some of the lunar observer instruments. So Chandrayaan and Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter both had radar systems on them. And they wanted to calibrate their systems. And so the ground-based calibration, turns out Arecibo can run at some of the same frequencies, and so we were able to help them with their calibration. And so they sent down this big rack of equipment and got it to Arecibo, and they tried it. We were supposed to run it remotely. It wasn't working. And it was like, and we were there. We were trying to do this experiment. You know, spacecraft, Arecibo, all these things. It's all very complicated to choreograph.
Yes.
There we were, trying to dance, and their machine wouldn't talk to the network or something. So I said, well, what does it do? I said, well, it generates this code. It's like, is it one of these? Okay, and how does it have to be synchronized? I have one of those. If you just want one of those, I have a spigot here with that, and I can plug it over into here and do this. Okay, let's go and take data. And every time people come to Arecibo, they see us with some of the systems are actually very... purpose-built, but the one we use is, it's got cables anywhere. It's a plug board.
Okay.
It's a huge plug board. So why do you use this old plug board system? It's like, because when somebody comes and says, can you blah? I said, yes, I can do that. Give me 5 minutes.
Because
we have all of those tools.
Right.
And so it was a great way to...
So sometimes the older technology is more flexible.
The older technology is flexible quickly. You can just rearrange it. So in software, you can make the perfect anything. And in fact, as we were moving along, we did switch to a lot of that because it was, okay, sometimes we just want this particular thing.
Mm.
But every time somebody said, well, can we decommission this? I said, no, keep that, because that one is really flexible. And when somebody comes up with a crazy request... we can do it.
Right. Okay. Cool.
And that's one of the things you want to, especially with a one of a kind instrument.
Well, like, right, because you're solving problems is what you're doing.
Right. Yeah.
That's the key. Yeah.
Right.
And
there's a lot of push actually now to have very purpose built instruments, and certainly in spacecraft you have to, just because you're so constrained in power and hardware and all those things. You can't build like a totally flexible system. So, but when you're doing a lot of these big observatories, there's a lot of value in maintaining that flexibility.
Right. So you not only served the community, but you also did your own research.
I also did my own research, which was a start. Well, so my graduate work was mostly theoretical on the structure of asteroids.
Mm.
The original problem was sort of like asteroids and the delivery of meteorites from the asteroid belt to Earth. And it's interesting because it started off doing some stuff that was mostly theoretical and semi-numerical. And by the end, the computers had gotten fast enough that you pretty much did everything numerically. And there's every few years, one of these semi-numerical classical results somebody would go redo numerically, and usually you'd find out that their general results were right, but that there were some weird edge cases that sometimes turned out to be very interesting. One of the ones I remember, this wasn't my work. This was, I have to think about who this was even. But there was this old theory, asteroids are brought in from the asteroid belt mostly by resonances that the Jupiter, forces of Jupiter and Saturn push back and forth on these asteroids and kind of move them in. And this has been done, again, mostly theoretically, because you couldn't just integrate the orbits numerically of each individual object to get them here. So you did equations to figure out basic, more or less, what was happening. Somebody did a numerical integration. But whenever you do a numerical integration, you're just sort of stepping along in time, right? You give it a push. And sometimes what you'll discover is, for some funny technical reasons, you say, well, I'm having to give it the pushes too fast and it's going to take too long. I'm just going to set this one aside to deal with later. Mm. And so in almost every numerical code that solves this sort of moving bodies problem does this. Say, these are too hard to deal with right now. I'm just going to mark them for later because I can't deal with them right now. They're slowing everything else down. And they were looking at their results, and I said, half of the asteroids ended up in that box of stuff I can't deal with. And they went and looked at them, and it turned out what they were doing is they would have a particular interaction, and they would get too close to the sun. Hmm. Right? They would get too close to the sun. And of course, the computer said, oh, you're too close to the sun. You're slowing me down. So stop. I said, well, if you get too close to the sun, other things not included in their code happen, like you get cooked.
Yeah, right.
And it turned out that under certain circumstances, these objects would get thrown into the sun, and they would disappear, right? They would get by the sun. Yeah. And so we discovered that some of these resonances could, under certain circumstances, be extremely rapid and strong, and push things either out of the solar system or into the sun, which hadn't been accounted for at all. It turned out what was causing this effect. And so it was an edge case that the numerical results, you could compute the probability of that, but it ended up that you were sort of as a dividing zero by zero too much. And it was just one of the cases that was too hard to do. Mm. So anyway, you find neat things that way. So what I was doing, I was actually just shock processes on asteroids. So on Earth, we understand how craters work. We've blown up holes in the Earth.
Sure.
We see craters on the Moon. Sure. We try to study craters. We've blown stuff up on the Earth and looked at the craters. And we have an understanding of, okay, this big of a bomb makes that big of a crater. This big of an impactor makes this big of a crater. Mm. We understand those things.
Right.
There's two regimes. There's strength and there's gravity.
Yes.
So if you have a big enough crater, doesn't matter what you're making it in. It can be water, can be rock, can be dirt. Doesn't matter. It's all about gravity. The gravity of the Earth determines what happens. Hmm. At the smaller scales, it's all about the strength of the materials.
Right. Yeah.
So I said, well, how about on an asteroid? On an asteroid, it's made out of, often cases, just pile of rocks.
Right.
There's no strength.
Rubble pile.
And the gravity's really small, too.
Right.
And we said, well, what happens when both the strength and the gravity go away? And so I ended up using one of these numerical codes and basically learned that when you do stuff like that, you end up with more questions than you started with. Not less. You don't actually answer questions. Yeah. But what I did end up figuring out was that it turned out that the shock processes, the actual process of hitting things, would break up the target, right? So that if you had a rock that was strong, the impact itself would fracture that rock.
Right.
And so that was an important process, and it would be controlled by some details that we just can't study on the Earth because they're not important on the Earth. Right. And so in that intermediate range, which, by the way, is almost about the size of the targets of the asteroids we're going to go visit,
a few
hundred meters,
yeah.
It's in between, and it turns out it's the breaking up of the... It's the actual impact physics itself that matters, and not so much either of the classical scenarios. So anyway, then I was at Arecibo taking pictures of these things, and we were trying to study some of those processes. And of course, what we ended up discovering was not at all what we were looking for. Right? I was just going to go ask this simple, is it this or that? It's like, oh, the actual answer is asteroids don't look anything like you thought they did once you finally had pictures of them.
Yeah, I mean, case in point, Rugu, we were all surprised. I mean, there's a lot of impact craters, probably impact craters, on Rugus. You know, I mean, that's
A day before we saw those pictures, I would have told you that we couldn't see them.
Fair enough. I was surprised
and then
myself. Yeah,
it's instead of craters, like, sure looks like it.
Looks like it. Yeah, absolutely. I know. Yeah. It's important to note that impacts are a major geologic force in the solar system,
right.
And anybody who looks at the moon knows that it's been impacted for 4.5 billion years. Well, sorry. Roughly. Sorry, 3.8 is the.
That's certainly one of the numbers, right?
Yeah, right. The last major event. Anyway, the point is, for a very long time, and on Earth, we also have been impacted a lot, but because of plate tectonics and active weathering and erosion, and we don't have a lot of evidence for it. But yeah, but little asteroids, surprisingly enough, yeah. How about that? So, on OSIRIS-REx, you came onto the mission as a scientist at Arecibo, imaging on two different campaigns, the asteroid Bennu, developing the shape model for the asteroid, which is incredibly important for navigating, or at least building your baseline navigation plan until you find out where the center of mass is on the object, / gravity. And then you became science team chief of the mission.
Right.
So that's quite a, first of all, big jump. Second, quite a scope of work you have as the science team chief.
Right.
And we talked about this a little bit a little while ago, but encompass it sort of briefly and what your actual work is about. As the coordinator of the science team, so to speak.
Right. So my job is to be, I think, the if a scientist has a question that they're trying to answer or a question about what they want to study, and they just want to have the scientific discussion of what we can do without worrying yet about asking for things, or because you'll have a problem, you'll ask the engineers, can I do this? And as a scientist, you're just... It's more than idly asking the question, but you're just sort of trying to do an investigation. And if you ask the engineering team a question, they feel like they need to give you a technical answer. And often you're not ready for that when you start.
Right,
you just want to have the scientific discussion of how would we go and look for this? Is this something we can study? Are we going to get a meaningful answer?
Hmm.
How would we get that answer? And so a lot of my job is getting those questions and organizing thinking about how we might do that, because I do have an understanding of what the instruments can do, and I do have,
right,
and
right.
Being here in Tucson, I have direct access to the
sure.
I can go talk to them in the hall and make informal requests and sort of explore the possibilities of what we might do.
Take temperatures and
exactly. And then say, and after those discussions, say, okay, this is something that I understand what you're trying to do. It's an interesting scientific question. I understand what we're going with it. And we've explored it well enough that I can go find out, is it something we can in fact do, right? Is it something that, is it physically possible?
Right,
within our capabilities?
Yeah.
Is it at a time when we can do this? I mean, sometimes we're just taking too much data and we can't entertain anymore. Other times we're more flexible. And so my job is to organize those things and to make sure that we're taking all the right data. And there's other people with actually pretty similar jobs, but they're usually the ones with answering much more specific requests of, okay, we know we need X, and how are we going to do it? And mine is more of, how would we go about doing this, and who would know the answer to that question, without worrying yet about what it's going to cost. Figure out what you want to do before you worry about the things like what it's going to cost and how hard is it. Because sometimes you'll find, if you talk to the right people, you might be able to find a simpler way than the straightforward way. And the simpler
sure.
way is like, oh, well, we already have this.
Yeah, we're already getting this data, so yeah.
And
exactly.
So all we have to do is turn this other thing on, and maybe it wouldn't be quite what you've asked for, but I bet you it'd be good enough to do what you want
right,
to do.
Right, right. So it's kind of a conducting sort of
right.
of all the different players, the engineers, the scientists, and even maybe some of the folks supporting.
And there's, and of course, everybody has multiple roles here. So I am also one of the people who is also on people to make sure that, that they're doing what they need to do, because as a, I also have a pure management job of just getting things done.
Sure, you do, but you're also still a scientist. You chime in on the science, and you make comments that are scientifically are motivated by your science thinking about science in order to talk to other people about their science, but at the same time, your own curiosity about these
things. My own curiosity. And that helps a lot with, because things will get to the engineering team as a, well, here's what we need to do. And sometimes I'll hear them sort of talking about something, and I can go and say, wait a minute, I think you're trying to solve the wrong problem. That's not quite the problem we're asking you to solve. Right. And I think you can come up with the answer to the problem we're trying to solve much simpler than what you're going at, right? I think what we're trying to do is, not, if it's that hard, that's not what we were trying to achieve.
Right.
And so let's see if we can rearrange this to be something that, that that is easier for all of us to do. Because, and I'll tell the people this a lot too. It's like, let's make the system flexible enough that we can do all these things. And also, let's be flexible so that when we ask somebody else to be flexible, they're more willing to do it.
Right.
If somebody asks, team says, how can you give a little on this? When possible, we want to say yes, because then that's going to be that one time we say, no, I really need that.
Now, that's usually an important point, is being flexible, especially in context of a space mission or just in life in general.
Right.
But as scientists, quite often we're not very flexible.
Right.
We're very rigid about our approach, or even some of us are even rigid about our interpretations.
That's a different question.
Yeah, it's a different issue. I know.
One of the real advantages, if people know you as being flexible, as trying to do this, then when you tell them, no, this is important, basically they'll believe you, right? That I'm not the person who's going to push them unless I really need it, then they can trust me that when I do say I really need something, that I've thought about it and I'm trying to
Well,
do it
you know, this meeting we just got finished, a two-day meeting looking at data production timeline for the mission. After we get to Bennu, wasn't clear to me how this would, one, work, the meeting, and two, what actually we would come out of it with. But it turns out that going through the Excel sheet that lists this time period, this, you know, this product, et cetera, line by line as you did through 2 days, was actually really, really freaking good.
And it also, it turns out, actually, I'm really happy with it because people asked me how happy I was yesterday. I said, yeah, we achieved today. We spent most of today because people were sort of mulling over in their minds. There were a couple little things where we said, this is working, but kind of not as well as we liked. Right? It's turning out to be really hard to do this thing. And four or five of us spent a lot of time today saying, I wonder if there's another way we could do that hard problem. Right? Is there an easier way to solve that problem that would take a lot of relief off? And I was kind of surprised because the people asking these questions were not the people I thought they were going to be ones who stick to the guns ones. They were like, maybe there's a way we can solve this particular problem so that rather than having struggle, so there's, we're trying to get one particular result and we're struggling to get it in the time we need. And we figured out a way so that we can get it a week before we need it. So a week isn't very flexible. A week is really working. And we think we're hoping we came up with a way where we can get it 2 months earlier.
Wow.
Which makes it from being a struggle to achieve to, yeah, that's no problem. This is looking like, okay, this is exactly what I hope to achieve. Get everybody thinking about the problems and saying, is there another way to do that? I'm hoping we've come up with a way to solve that problem.
That's great. Yeah.
And it won't, we're still going to do the other thing, but it'll take the pressure off those difficult observations by letting us say we've answered this particular question that we were stressed about an easier way and 2 months earlier. That's it. So that kind of cooperation is really nice. And I think that did arrive because we were all saying, here's what I need, and here's the things I'd like, and let's negotiate.
Well, I think, two things to that. One, for me, it also brought into perspective elements of the production schedule that I had forgotten about, basically. It's been so long since I looked at it. Number one. Number two, most people don't realize that on a space mission, you have to plan things out. years in advance of what you're going to do when and why and how much power you're going to need for this instrument and that instrument and data dumping into the, you know, all that has to be planned out, and then at the same time become flexible.
Right.
Because things will change. You will meet the unexpected, right, whatever it is. And then the other thing that happened to me in this last 2 days, I don't know about for you, but for me was, I remember when we got the award, but it was like 3 days of partying.
Right.
And the fourth morning, and I'll never forget it, I woke up in my apartment in Manhattan, and I was a bit frazzled around the edges for obvious reasons. And I'm in the shower, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, oh my God, I've got so much work to do. So the first day of this meeting, well, when I went home at night talking to Dante, I thought, oh my God, it's just really hitting me. This is real. Really quickly, we got a month and we're there. Oh my God, I can't go here in the fall. I can't go there. I've got to come here.
Right, well,
I got to change that, you know, my whole thinking process now. Even though you know it intellectually, it became an actualization at some point for me. And I predict, because I was talking to Kevin and Vicky, and they're all kind of thinking the same thing last night at dinner. And we're all like, oh shit, we got a lot of work to do. So
yeah.
I very much enjoy talking to you as always. I can continue. We're going to continue for a few more minutes. But at the same time, you're doing all this. You have a family.
Yes.
You have a wife. You have three kids. Your wife's also a planetary scientist,
mm-hmm,
working on the mission. At some point, I'll get her on the podcast as well. that's not uncommon at
right.
this mission.
Right? It's not uncommon at this mission. Right?
Yeah, the PI, his spouse, I interviewed her before, Kate, good friend. I think, I'm not sure the question I want to ask, but the dynamics of having that kind of support at the same time must be wonderful.
It has its good and bad features, like everything, right? It's good to have, right, that my family's involved, right, so they understand what we're doing. On the other hand, it does mean that there's a lot of pressure sometimes when you'd like there not to be. And there's things like, okay, yeah, we're not going to both, my wife and I are not going to go to the same meeting just because our kids are old enough that we could leave them home alone, but they're not old enough that we really want to.
Sure.
And so we do have to do some of that. And of course, we just... since the mission's, as you pointed out, the mission's getting hot and heavy right now, so we said, okay, this is our last vacation. We're going far away, and we're going for a while.
Right. Yeah, that's very good. That's really fun. In fact, I was going to go to, I know this in a sense, I was going to go to Hawaii for a long weekend, because, you know, I love Hawaii.
Right.
And right after the curation meeting in August, and it's just I got a meeting now on that Monday afterwards,
right,
and something on a Tuesday now, and I'm like, I can't blow these off, you know. I that's it. I'm done. I had my vacation in Paris for 10 days,
right,
in June,
right? Yeah, no.
Which was wonderful. It just, you know, rebooted me. But that's it now until I don't know when.
Right. It's
2 years from now, maybe.
2 years from now, we're gonna be basically.
You know, after we tag, then maybe everything's okay. Stow, lock up, then bye. I'm going to Honolulu for 2 weeks, 2 months.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's just the way it's going to be. In fact, I might even be here over Christmas.
I think almost right. We have serious work over Christmas. And we are actually, what was one of the things we did day before yesterday is look and say, some of these things we have in the timeline, if they are over a major holiday or a major like school break,
we
do want to say that one's not critical, but some of them are. No, that one is critical, and those people are, we need to be extra nice to them because they're going to have to work over that school break and that holiday.
Right.
We just have to be really nice to them because there isn't, they have to do that. Because we need it on that day, because the spacecraft is in space orbiting something, and it's gravity, and gravity doesn't take a holiday.
Exactly, and that's also the element of devotion. I've talked about it before on the podcast. The element of devotion in science is that we're also devoted to our science and to our jobs, and I don't think a lot of people appreciate that. Devotion typically is considered to be something you have at home or in a religious setting, but scientists are also very devoted people. Yeah. Mike, I want to thank you very much.
All right.
This was really fun. And we'll be working very closely together for the next many years, so we may have more podcasts together. Thank you very much. Anything you want to say before I go?
Not particularly. Thank you,
Harold. All right. Thank you.